things get a little bit grim. But this is especially heinous.
Did you tell the police that she was murdered, May?
Nope.
Witchy ghost stuff.
Ah! That made me scared.
A spooky girl amateur hour.
What do we
say? Joe Bean, green bean.
Joe Bean.
Hi.
Hi!
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing just fine.
We're all doing great.
Doing so good.
We just ate soup.
We did. It was delicious. My mouth is a little burnt though.
It was a little, it was warm.
It was delivered to me in a thermos, which did indeed keep it very hot.
It's a Yeti.
Yeah. It did its heckin' job.
Only the best.
Thank you.
For you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's officially soup weather now.
It is. Oh my God. Yesterday was the first day of fall in real timeline.
Yes.
It really, it came in strong. Came in real strong for us.
The temperature went from 90 to 55 like it saw a state trooper.
Absolutely.
And slammed on the brakes.
So hard. Skid marks.
It was like, cold.
Yeah. Well, I'm not speeding.
No,
I'm cold. Do you see all these orange leaves?
This is how I travel all the time.
I am careful driver.
I love the weather, though.
Yeah, I do,
and
too.
I'm here for it.
I got out my big fuzzy orange sweater yesterday. I wore it all day yesterday. I wore it all day today. I'm thinking about washing it and wearing it tomorrow. Because it is my favorite one.
I have worn the same sweater for 2 days in a row. I changed to come here.
Wow.
I know.
Impressive.
Thank you. I am really doing the most for you.
My friend Jamie and I just got back from Disney World,
mm-hmm.
and I overpacked.
Of course, as you do.
Of course. But I would rather, I stay by this, I would rather overpack than underpack, you know?
I mean, that's fine. Yeah, I get it.
But
I'm not that person.
Really?
Oh my God. When I go on vacation, I have to scavenge. I'm pulling out like the most microscopic moisturizer tester tube that's half used and being like, this will last me for 8 days.
Oh Lord. I can get by on some like pretty skimpy makeup. Mm-hmm. Like I do take all my testers when I travel.
Yeah.
Like I don't really like to travel with full size stuff. But when it comes to clothes, I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to want. So I brought 2 pairs of biker shorts, a pair of jeans, a pair of jean shorts, and a pair of leggings.
Yeah.
I wore the same pair of biker shorts for 6 out of 7 days.
I
changed biker shorts on the very last day.
I love that.
I have never felt more comfortable. And I was like looking at my jeans and I was like, why did you even bring these?
It what were you thinking?
A million degrees down there.
Really?
Oh God. It was so hot and 100% humidity.
Oh God.
I recently got bangs and I think they're super cute and they really fit a fall winter vibe.
Yes.
Summer?
No.
Oh my God.
Plastered to the forehead.
To my forehead. And I don't have straight hair and I don't have curly hair. It just is a wavy little mess. And so immediately, as soon as the
humidity
hits it, it just frizzed up.
Oh man.
Frizzy bangs.
That's a bummer.
Not cute.
Can't relate. It's cold here. You wouldn't know how I know it's like genuine fall.
Tell me.
I saw, and you know what? Listen, I'm so grateful for like the ability to adapt.
Uh-huh.
And I will still stand by that I've gotten over my arachnophobia.
Yeah, you have.
Thank you.
Big proud.
Thank you. There was a spider.
Uh-oh.
Inside of my home. A couple days ago.
A trespasser.
When I tell you that this was the biggest spider in the wild I have ever seen.
Oh, jeez.
I mean, it was hiding behind, it was in my laundry room.
Okay.
It was hiding behind a laundry basket. So I picked up the laundry basket.
The worst.
And it's, you know how most spiders like scurry?
Yeah.
He was too big to scurry. I swear I saw him flex before he nonchalantly like crawled ever so slowly like in between my dryer and the wall. So then I knew I needed, like, a long-range weapon.
Uh-huh.
And all I could find was a spritz of bleach. So I tried to reach him with the bleach.
Yeah.
Couldn't.
Uh-huh.
And he just disappeared.
Oh, I don't know. He's a resident now.
He is somewhere in my home, and I know this for sure. He was probably this big. He's like legs. Of course, he wasn't flat. He was like up.
Uh-huh.
On. Oh, Taylor. I swear. And he like cat called me on his way out. He was so big.
He's got squatter's rights now.
I swear. He's getting utility bills in his name at my address.
You should probably talk to him about that.
Has a CDL and a GED. And he was taking up residence. In my house. I think it was like it had to be a wolf spider, but like the wolf spider that carries its babies on its butt. He was so fucking big.
Oh,
and I
didn't
do laundry for 3 days, so I have no clean clothes.
I can understand how you got there.
Thank you.
I do.
Thank you.
I have orb weaver spiders.
The yellow and black ones?
Sure. Of those. And
yeah.
I don't know. That's not what Ryan calls them.
Okay.
So I assume that he knows what he's talking about, but like in hindsight, probably not.
Okay.
So I have big spiders.
Okay.
On my front patio.
Yes.
And they will make their webs mm-hmm. and just hang from them, and I can see them in the porch light.
Yes.
And oh my God, they are so big.
Like big butt, skinny leg boys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have a concoction that I have created.
Okay.
That I keep next to my front door.
Okay.
And it is Dawn dish soap with a little bit of water, vinegar, and then peppermint oil.
I've heard that peppermint oil like dissuades spiders.
Yeah. And then I put some, it's the Young Living Thieves. They have a cleaning solution.
Yeah.
I put some of that in it too.
Yeah. I love thieves oil.
And that's got like clove in it and it's pretty potent. And I'll spray spiders with that and it kills them within like, I give them about 3 minutes.
Patent that.
Yeah.
Could have used that. I had to defend my home.
I am so sorry that your weaponry
against not. It was pure bleach in a spray bottle and it didn't even, Taylor, it was
tie-dye
like,
spiders now.
He took that. Like Tarzan in the rainforest.
Oh
like,
my God.
It was like I just gave him a light bath. It didn't even slow him down.
What?
He was so gross.
Ooh. Sorry.
It's okay. It was a crime for him to break an udder.
Oh, good.
Did you like that?
Yeah,
segue?
I did.
Thank you.
Oh, gosh. When does this come out?
This is spooky.
15th? No.
No.
Is it?
8th.
8th?
What day is it today? Somebody tell us. Yell it in your car.
Yeah, I know that everybody is big mad about us not knowing anything.
I don't know what to tell you. This is the 8th. It's okay. October 8th.
So next weekend, come see us.
At DeadCon.
At DeadCon.
We would love to see your like beautiful smiling face.
Absolutely.
Come hang out with us. It's in downtown Fort Wayne. The website is linked in the show notes.
Yeah, it's also deadcon.com.
Deadcon.com.
Yeah, but I'll link it in the show notes for sure. And it would be a crime if you didn't come see us. All right, are you going first today?
I believe you are.
Oh, I am? Excellent. I can't wait. I am not going to lead you on.
Okay. You're more upfront than every person I've ever dated in my life.
I appreciate that. Today, we have updates on this trial.
Whoa.
And I am so sorry I thought that I would have an update by today. Like, I thought we would have a verdict, and we don't.
Open-ended.
I think by the time that this actually airs, we will have an ending. So if we do, I will call you and we will record our phone conversation and I will insert that.
Okay. Got it. I love it.
But I was like, it's too late for me to
back out,
do a different crime. and it's a long boy.
Okay. So. I'm nestled in. Listen, I'm curled up.
I am so sorry.
Don't you apologize to me, Mr. Sister.
All right. I have quite a few sources. We have an article from True Crime Buzz by Gina Tron, a CNN article by Mark Savage, a BuzzFeed News article by Jim DeRogatis, and then some others by the New York Times that are sprinkled in, and I have the authors kind of as I talk about them.
Okay.
Robert Sylvester Kelly was born January 8th, 1967 in Chicago, Illinois. He has an older sister, an older brother, and a younger brother. His mother, Joanne Kelly, raised her children in the Baptist church, where she sang lead in the choir. Joanne was a single mother, and the father of her children was absent the majority of their lives. Robert's childhood was riddled with sexual abuse, trauma, and loss. He found solace in music and would eventually become the man that we know today, R. Kelly.
Whoa. Okay. Wasn't ready for this.
Buckle
up. That's a big name.
Yeah. Do you know? Did you watch?
I didn't watch any of the documentaries because I get a little squeamish when it comes to sexual assault.
Okay. I'm so sorry. Things don't get too graphic.
Okay.
Except for, like, there's one part that does get graphic. Okay, so R. Kelly's first solo album, 12 Play, was released on November 9th, 1993, and gave the singer his first number one hit, Bump and Grind.
Oh, God. Which, a middle school dance classic.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. which spent 12 weeks at number one on the Billboard Hot R&B Singles Chart. But things quickly took off for Kelly in 1996 when he released I Believe I Can Fly, which was released for the film Space Jam.
I did not know that R. Kelly sang that.
Really?
Yeah. Really?
That's R. Kelly.
For some, I really thought it was like Boys to Men or Seal or something.
Somebody respectable?
Yes.
No. Okay. I'm so sorry. You're going to have to take it off all your playlists now.
Fuck.
This song was played at graduations, in churches, and just a lot of really important moments in people's lives. Yeah. This was like a really inspirational song.
Yeah.
And it catapulted him into a new realm of music industry.
Oh, great.
I Believe I Can Fly reached number two on the Billboard Hot 100 and won 3 Grammys.
Wow.
Yeah. Kelly's manager, Barry Hankerson, had a niece, and he was also trying to break her into the music business as well. Aaliyah Houghton was only 12 when she signed to Black Ground Records. She recorded her first album when she was 14.
Is this like Aaliyah? Aaliyah?
Aaliyah. Aaliyah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay.
At the time, R. Kelly was around a lot as they worked in the same studio and shared a common connection in Barry Hankerson. Kelly became Aaliyah's mentor, lead songwriter, and producer of her first album, Age Ain't Nothing But a Number.
So many heaves. It's yucky, for sure.
Big yuck.
Yeah.
Aaliyah and Kelly became the talk of the town after the release of Age Ain't Nothing But a Number, as rumors started swirling that the two were romantically involved.
Yeah.
As she recalled to Vibe magazine in 1994, she and Kelly would go watch a movie and go eat when she got tired and would then come back and work. She described the relationship between herself and Kelly as being rather close.
What does that mean, though?
Well, Vibe magazine found a marriage certificate that listed the couple married on August 31st, 1994, when Aaliyah would have been 15 years old, but the certificate listed her age as 18.
Ooh, what?
Her parents were not aware of the marriage before it happened, and they had it annulled in February of 1995.
As they should.
The two always denied the marriage publicly. But in the 2019 documentary, Surviving R. Kelly, quite a few people close to Kelly say that they were well aware of the situation. Demetrius Smith Sr., a member of Kelly's entourage, wrote in his book that Kelly once told him that he thought Aaliyah might be pregnant. Javante Cunningham, a former backup dancer, claimed to have witnessed Kelly and Aaliyah having sexual intercourse on his tour bus.
Ew!
Yeah. Smith also said that he was the one who helped Aaliyah forge the necessary documents to show her age as 18, so the marriage could take place. Smith said in the documentary that he regrets his actions and is not proud of the role he played during that time. In May of 1997, Aaliyah admitted to the court that she had lied about her age and asked the court to remove all records of the marriage, as she was not old enough to get married without her parents' consent. By 1997, she had cut all ties with Kelly. Sadly, the bad press made it difficult for producers for her to find producers for her second album, which is just ridiculous. She was the child.
Right.
In this situation, but she was being punished. At any rate, she was still able to be a successful artist and was called the Princess of R&B. She starred in several films and sadly died in an airplane accident in 2001.
She was in the middle of filming Queen of the Damned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, in
one of the best movies of all time.
Say fucking swear. Did you know?
Such a good one.
In those final scenes, they were filmed after she died and her brother filmed them in her place. Like, really? Got dressed up. Mm-hmm. In her costume.
Wow, that's drive. How they did Paul Walker. And after he died in Fast and Furious.
I don't know who that is.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm sorry if I just... Not trying to make people mad. I just am uneducated.
Allie's heart just broke into a shattered into a million
Allie,
pieces.
No!
My yeah.
Pally Allie.
Okay. So that was really the first media storm on kind of R. Kelly and his nefarious ways.
Is that like his first controversy?
Yes.
Okay.
But the controversies started before that. Like, what? His antics were before Aaliyah. Aaliyah was just the first one to get notoriety from it. Or not okay. notoriety, that's not the right word. Like, their relationship was the first to get media attention, basically. Okay. Tiffany Hawkins was a shy girl from Chicago who loved to sing. She said in Surviving R. Kelly that singing was the best way for her to express herself. Her home life wasn't amazing, and she started going out and staying out all night. Her mom's boyfriend was physically abusive, and her mom didn't do much to protect her from that. Kelly was just 15 years old, a sophomore in high school, when she met R. Kelly with a friend from high school in 1991. The girls were on a city bus when they spotted his car, and when the bus, like, pulled to the next stop, they got out and walked to R. Kelly's car and talked to him. Kelly gave her his home address and told her that she should come over to hang out.
Oh, God.
She grabbed a few of her friends and took them to his home. She sang for him, and Kelly seemed to be really impressed. As the evening went on, her friends were all coming and going from Kelly's bedroom. Every time she peeked her head in, he was having sex with a different girl. At the time, the friends she brought with her were between the ages of 14 and 16.
Oh, Jesus.
And when I read that, you know, I know how it feels to be an obsessed fan. If my high school crush, like my high school musical crush, I saw on the street corner, absolutely I would get off that bus and go talk to them.
Mine was Dr. Gregory House.
I love that for you.
Thank you.
That actually says a lot.
Yeah.
It explains a lot.
I'm sure it does.
But, I mean, just to, like, go up to him and, like, I just think if I were 15 and my crush gave me his address, of course I would go.
Hell yeah.
I would lie to anybody to get to go. There. Absolutely. That's 15-year-olds.
Yes. That's what they do.
Soon, Tiffany was spending more and more time with Kelly, and he helped her when she needed it, providing her with food and a place to stay when she didn't want to go home.
Ooh.
In 1996, Tiffany sued Kelly for $10 million.
Whoa!
Because she suffered personal injuries and severe emotional harm because she had had sex with the singer, and he encouraged her to participate in group sex with him with underage girls. According to Rolling Stone. That lawsuit was settled for $250,000. Tiffany would be the first to publicly accuse R. Kelly of sexual abuse.
Good job.
Yep. She was the first in a long line of victims, and the line should have ended with her, but unfortunately, Tiffany's story is just the tip of the iceberg.
Oh.
In 2001, Tracy Sampson sued R. Kelly and accused him of introducing her into an indecent sexual relationship when she was 17. Tracy said that in the case against him, he often tried to control every aspect of my life, including who I could see and where I could go. The case was settled out of court for an undisclosed amount. On February 3rd, 2002, a video surfaced that allegedly shows Kelly violating an underage girl by having sex with her and then urinating on her.
There it is.
Yep. The news broke as Kelly was about to perform at the opening ceremony of the 2002 Winter Olympics.
Yikes! What a non-ideal time for a scandal.
Not good.
Not good.
Kelly says that he is not the man in the video.
Of course.
In June of the same year, Kelly was indicted in Chicago on 21 counts of child pornography. He was arrested by the Miami-Dade police at his Florida vacation home, and he was released after posting bail, which was set at $750,000.
Great.
The victim refused to testify at the trial, and a Chicago jury found Kelly not guilty of those charges. God. It took 6 years for this trial to come to a close, and during this time, Kelly released his Trapped in the Closet album and was nominated for an Image Award by the NAACP.
Oh, great.
But while police were searching his home in Florida, they found more images of an underage girl on a digital camera. According to the Chicago Sun-Times, the girl in those photos was the same girl in the video that got him indicted in Chicago in the first place.
Oh my God.
Kelly was arrested on January 22nd, 2003 by police investigators from Polk County and Miami-Dade County on those charges of 12 counts of possession of child pornography. Kelly was later released from jail just hours after a bond posted of $12,000. In March of 2004, these charges were dropped due to lack of probable cause for the search warrants.
Oh my God.
Just non-stop. Non-stop with this guy.
Bullshit excuses for him to get off.
It's so ridiculous. Kelly was sued again in April of 2002 by Patrice Jones, and this would have been a few months after the sex tape was released.
Oh my God.
Jones claimed that he impregnated her when she was underage, and he forced her to have an abortion. Now, if y'all are keeping track, this means that Kelly was sued in April, May, and June of 2002.
He's on a roll.
All by different women.
Okay.
Another woman named Montina Woods sued Kelly for videotaping them having sex without her knowledge. The recording was circulated and sold online, and she settled outside of court.
Wow.
Things go quiet in the world of R. Kelly until 2017, when more allegations appear. Once again, we bridge the gap between two of our buckets as we now dive into what some of the parents are calling the R. Kelly sex cult.
Yeah.
Three women of Kelly's inner circle came forward to BuzzFeed. Their names are Cheryl Mack, Kitty Jones, and Asante McGee. Cheryl Mack was his personal assistant. Kitty and Asante admitted that they lived with him and had sexual relations with him for more than 5 years before they left.
Wow.
These women say that Kelly still had women living with him in his Atlanta guest house and his Chicago residence in Trump Tower. One of these women was the daughter of Jay and Tim Savage, a girl named Jocelyn Savage. Jocelyn was with her mom, Jay, at an R. Kelly show when they were invited back to meet Kelly after the show. Jay says that they spent upwards of 2 hours with Kelly, and they talked about how he could further her career and make her a star. He gave Jocelyn his contact info, and Jay had heard of the allegations about Kelly, but she just thought it would be okay if she was with her. Like, I'm a parent. I can protect her. She's only going to see him when she's with me. She instructed Jocelyn not to contact or be alone with Kelly unless one of her parents was there. Months later, they found out that she had been talking to Kelly and meeting with him secretly.
Of course.
Of course. Of course.
She's a teenager. That's what they do.
Like, he is a platinum recording artist.
You're just going to be like,
let her have his phone number and be like, don't talk to him without me there.
Right.
Girl.
That's not.
Listen,
no.
I'm not trying to victim blame anybody, but.
Honest.
You got to expect less of teenagers.
Maybe it's just because, like, I was such a dirtbag teen. I'm just a teenage. Taylor, insert Weezer.
Okay. On it.
Maybe it's because I was such a piece of shit as a teenager, but I could never with a teenage girl.
No.
I'm putting bars on the windows.
I was sneaky bad.
Yes, like, me too.
I was not somebody that you would point to in the cafeteria and be like, that girl's doing some shit.
Yeah.
Oh, no. And I wholeheartedly believe in my heart and soul that what I was doing was not bad.
Yeah.
And nobody, adults especially, could tell me anything else.
No.
Like, come on.
Mm-mm.
Oh, my gosh. Freaking ridiculous. So, anyway, the police and the FBI are not willing to help the couple bring their daughter home because she is past the age of consent, she is not missing, and she insists that she's fine.
Great.
Adults are allowed to enter into non-traditional relationships without their parents' consent.
Children aren't.
No, but she wasn't a child when she did that. The last time that they saw Jocelyn, her mother said that it was like she had been brainwashed. She just kept saying that she's in love with Kelly and that he's the only one that cares for her.
Oh.
Super gross. On July 17th, 2017, TMZ released a video of Jocelyn filming herself saying that she was totally fine and happy. I'm not being brainwashed or anything like that, Jocelyn said. However, she would not reveal where she was, and she would not speak on her relationship with Kelly.
Gross.
Yeah. These women get swept up in promises made by Kelly, saying that they would be he would be willing to help them with their musical careers. They end up moving in with him, thinking, wow, this is it. A celebrity loves me. I'm going to make it. And then suddenly they are in a situation where they have to ask to eat, ask to sleep, ask to go to the bathroom.
Ooh.
Cheryl Mack described Kelly as a puppet master. In addition to controlling their behavior, he also confiscates their means of communication. So no phones, laptops, nada.
It's prison.
Yep. They would have to ask if they wanted to use it for something, and then he would give them like a time limit. And you bet the girls would have to tell him specifically what they wanted the phone for and who they were calling. The girls were also not allowed to take photos of their rooms or of Kelly while they were living with him.
Oh.
Yeah. According to Cheryl, Kitty, and Asante, they told BuzzFeed News that the woman living in Kelly's guest house or his Chicago recording studio included a 31-year-old den mother who trained newcomers on how Kelly liked to be pleasured sexually. She had been... Yeah. She had been best friends since high school with a girl with the girl in the videotape for which Kelly was tried in 2008. She recently parted ways with Kelly, these sources say.
Wow.
A 25-year-old woman who has also been a part of Kelly's scene for almost 7 years. A recent arrival, a 19-year-old model who had been photographed in public with Kelly and named on musical gossip websites, a rarity among the women in his circle. An Atlanta songwriter who began her relationship with Kelly around 2009 when she was 19. She is now 26. And an 18-year-old singer from Polk County, Florida. Max said that the Florida singer is Kelly's favorite and his number one girl.
Gross.
Yeah. Kelly also has a say in how the women dress. He likes them to wear sweatpants suits because he doesn't want them to get attention from other men. When other men come around the house, he tells the women to face the wall so that they don't get looked at by the male company.
Ew, what the fuck?
He's garbage. Truly garbage.
Oh my god.
Asante puts it best when she describes the differences between R. Kelly and Robert. She said that R. Kelly is the sweetest person you'll ever meet, but Robert is the devil.
I'm horrified.
Yeah. The BuzzFeed News article by Jim DeRogatis, which, can we just get a moment of celebration for Mr. Jim? He spent 20 years of his career unrelentingly investigating and reporting on R. Kelly's nasty ass.
Good job, sir.
King.
I love men who call out other men.
Yeah. And this guy is like an older white guy.
Yes!
He is just like, no.
That is not what we expect from old white men.
No.
But I appreciate.
He is an angel. A sweet angel reporter.
I'm gonna send him a Christmas card.
Yeah, I should. Anyway, this report fueled the fire and more allegations were brought to light after he published this article.
Amazing.
It is so well done, so long. I could have just read his article.
Okay.
But Geronda Pace breaks her non-disclosure agreement and speaks out about her sexual relationship with Kelly while she was underage. Kitty Jones claims that the star starved her, coerced her into sexual encounters with other women, and physically abused her. Kitty, among other members of R. Kelly's inner circle, also spoke to a BBC 3 documentary in March 2018. One former friend and collaborator, Lavelle Jones, said that Kelly asked him to scout out women that looked young at parties and claimed that it was common knowledge that the singer preferred younger girls.
Ew.
Again, Kelly denied the allegations. In 2018, the hashtag #MeRKelly campaign garnered the public's attention once again. The movement targeted music performers, music platforms, ticket sellers, and concert venues. Music platforms agreed to demote the songs, so they would take them off, like, their playlists and stuff like that, but you could still search for it.
Okay.
But if you just put in, like, an R&B playlist, it's Kelly not wouldn't be on there. But eventually decided to re-promote them.
Oh, great.
So they just did it until the Mew R. Kelly campaign was done, and then they were like, we're just going to go ahead and slide those back in. Around this time, another victim sued R. Kelly for intentionally transmitting an STD to her.
Intentionally?
Yeah. A doctor on one of these trials, I can't remember which one, it could have been this one, testified that he tested R. Kelly for STDs. He has herpes, I think.
Okay.
And told him he had to contact all of his sexual partners and let them know.
What a fucking list.
Yeah. And he didn't do that.
Oh, well.
Which is a felony.
It's a fucking dick move, too.
Yeah. So,
Ew.
Finally, in 2019, we got the surviving R. Kelly Lifetime documentary, which exploded and exposed to the masses so many of Kelly's crimes up until that point. The documentary's first part is 6 episodes long, and I watched them over quarantine. I gotta tell you, I was shook about it. I was completely enraptured by these women's stories and just their own personal experiences with this absolute garbage human. 2 weeks after the documentary aired, Kelly was dropped by his record company, and his concerts across the U.S. and New Zealand were canceled.
Good.
In February 2019, a lawyer claimed that he had a video of Kelly having sex with a 14-year-old girl.
Ooh.
Kelly was charged in Chicago with 10 counts of aggravated criminal sexual abuse. He pleaded not guilty.
Mm.
Later, an additional 11 charges of sexual assault and abuse against a minor between the ages of 13 and 16 were filed. In July 2019, Kelly is indicted in Illinois and Brooklyn for 2 completely separate charges. An article by Mark Savage from the BBC says, combined, the allegations depict an organized effort from the star and his associates to recruit and transport underage girls over state lines for illegal sexual purposes, including the production of child pornography, as well as conspiracy to obstruct justice by destroying evidence and bribing or threatening witnesses. Kelly's lawyer, Steve Greenberg, says in a statement that his client was aware of the allegations and the charges were not a surprise. Another article from the New York Times, written by Troy Clausen, says, Mr. Kelly faces 1 count of racketeering, a charge that is built around 4 underlying crimes that prosecutors say he committed as a part of a criminal scheme he led for decades. But this charge itself only requires that 2 of those crimes be proven. In addition to the racketeering charge, Mr. Kelly is accused of 8 violations of the Mann Act, a law barring sex trafficking across state lines. Mr. Kelly, 54, has pleaded not guilty and has a long denied accusations against him. Again, Kelly says not guilty, and days later, prosecutors from Minnesota file prostitution charges against Kelly. So this is the 3rd U.S. state where Kelly is on trial.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Good. Hold this man accountable.
Finally, a judge with some sense denies R. Kelly bail.
As he fucking should.
So that was in 2019.
Okay.
He has been in jail ever since.
I love that.
And now, we enter the year 2020. Thank you.
Shittiest drum roll.
Oh, God. We enter the year 2020 where all hell is breaking loose and free.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kelly is still on trial, and his trial was postponed from March until August 2020 when 3 of Kelly's henchmen were charged with... This story is ridiculous.
His henchmen.
Truly. They were charged with trying to intimidate, harass, or pay off witnesses.
They were?
Yes. The three witnesses came forward saying that one was offered $500,000 to stay silent. One was threatened with her nudes, and another said her car was lit on fire in her driveway.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
That's intense.
It's so bananas. This is relatively unimportant, but I know that this is going to bring you joy. Kelly got the shit beat out of him by a fellow inmate in late August of last year.
That makes my heart so happy.
Uh-huh. His legal team tried to have him released as his safety was a concern.
Nah.
They said no. And he's all right. The assaulting inmate to Michigan.
Nah, he's good.
Yeah.
You're fine. Don't you worry about him.
In June of this year, Kelly replaced his legal team. So, June 2021.
New team.
New team.
Okay. Trying to go in a different route.
Yeah. His trial began August 18th, 2021. One of the very first things that he admitted to was his sexual relationship with Aaliyah. The prosecution called dozens of witnesses who detailed Kelly's crimes. Their accounts were backed by former employees of Kelly whose testimonies indicated that they were paid off to look the other way. One witness was an expert on abusive relationships, a woman named Dawn Hughes. Hughes testified that studies show that many abusers isolate, demean, subjugate, and spy on their victims as a means of control. all of which were tactics that Kelly allegedly used.
Wow.
The prosecution finished their closing statement on today, September 23rd, at 12:30 p.m.
Okay, a mere 5 hours ago.
Cutting it close. So the closing remarks were delivered by Elizabeth Geddes, G-E-D-D-E-S.
Okay.
And it took us a total of 6 hours for her to recap all of everything that the jury had heard.
Holy shit.
6 hours.
That's the longest summary.
Yeah. And they were like, don't forget about this witness and this witness.
Oh,
and
my
this witness.
God.
Woof.
Quite an antithesis on that one.
Yes. Geddes said Mr. Kelly used lies, manipulation, and threats and physical abuse to dominate his victims. She also added that his immense wealth and fame allowed him to hide in plain sight. Also, a round of applause for Ms. Geddes, who has worked in the Brooklyn Eastern District for 15 years. She currently heads the Civil Rights section of the office's criminal division. At the end of her closing remarks, she simply asked the jury for one thing: convict him.
Wow.
And now it's the defense's turn. R. Kelly's lawyer is a Mr. Devereaux Canick. Canick closed his arguments today by attacking the credibility of the accusers, describing them as opportunists, liars, and obsessive fans. Mr. Canick repeatedly accused federal prosecutors of criminalizing illegal activity like kinky sex between people of different ages and using the romantic nicknames like Daddy, which accusers said Mr. Kelly forced them to call him. It is almost a crime to call a man Daddy, Mr. Canick said. He asked the jury to forget the fluff and be courageous and to find Kelly not guilty of the charges. Wow. Unfortunately, that is all I have for you.
Ew! I know it's not your fault. I'm not blaming you, but ew. Come on.
I'm so sorry. I was refreshing my feed at like 5 o'clock today. Like, please.
Some update.
Yeah, no, I think that we'll probably know something by the end of next week.
Okay.
So if I text you and I'm like, you have to answer your phone, I have to record your...
So like, your reaction.
Your reaction to this.
Okay, got it. I will. So like a jury right now in real time where we live right now, a jury is deliberating.
Yes.
That's fucking cool.
Yeah. I don't see a way for them to not convict him. I just don't see a way.
It sounds like a pretty solid gamble.
It's gotta be. They can.
Boy, are we gonna be pissed.
So one interesting thing that I read was it seems to be a trend that like the longer the trial, the longer the deliberation.
Yeah.
With the exception of Keith Raniere. And
how long do they deliberate?
6 hours.
That's not a long time.
No, it's not. So that was one thing that a lot of the news articles pointed to, was like people are expecting a long deliberation, but everybody was like, don't forget about this guy.
Yeah, right.
That got convicted in 6 hours. So
like a boss.
Yeah. That's my story for you today.
I'm sorry. That was really good.
Ooh. I started it like 3 weeks ago.
That's a lot to go over.
It was a lot. Hi.
Hi.
So even though to you it sounds like we've been gone for approximately 15 seconds.
It's been a couple weeks.
Probably 2 weeks has gone by.
Yeah.
For Jenny and I, but we have an update
for you. Let's do the time warp again.
So the jurors, I'm going to just read you an article from CNN written by Sonia Mogi. Jurors have found R&B singer R. Kelly guilty of racketeering, including acts of bribery and sexual exploitation of a child, along with separate charges of sex trafficking.
Fucking yikes.
I was so thrilled.
Floored.
When this verdict came back. It says, this federal case in the Eastern District of New York, Kelly faced a total of 9 counts. 1 count of racketeering with 14 underlying acts that included sexual exploitation of a child, kidnapping, bribery, and sex trafficking charges, and also 8 additional counts of violations of the Mann Act, a sex trafficking law. Kelly was found guilty of 9 counts, 1 count of racketeering, and 8 counts of violating the Mann Act. Of the 14 underlying acts for the racketeering count. He needed to be found guilty of at least two to be convicted of that count. Jurors found prosecutors had proven all but two of the 14 underlying racketeering acts.
Fuck yeah. Good job, prosecution. Yep.
Today's guilty verdict forever brands R. Kelly as a predator who used his fame and fortune to prey on the young and vulnerable and the voiceless for his own sexual gratification, said Jacqueline Kasulis, an acting U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of New York. R. Kelly is a predator who used his inner circle to ensnare underage girls and young men and women for decades in a sordid web of sex abuse, exploitation, and humiliation, Kasulis added. She said that the victims were brave for coming forward and telling their stories. To the victims in this case, your voices were heard and justice was finally served. Attorney Gloria Allred, who represented three of the six victims who testified at the trial, said Kelly is the worst predator she's ever pursued. First, he used the power of his celebrity to recruit vulnerable underage girls for the purpose of sexually abusing them. These were not May through October relationships, which is what his defense attorney I want him to be in jail for eternity.
Yes.
wanted the jury to believe these were crimes against children and some adults. She said the verdict also was a message to other celebrities who prey on others. Kelly did not have any reaction when the verdict to the verdict when it was read in court, and according to his attorney, he was not expecting this verdict. Yeah, because he's gotten off every single time before.
Sure. For like the past however many 20 fucking years.
Yeah, absolutely. Attorney Devereaux Canick said outside of the court, the government, quote, cherry-picked evidence to support its narrative. Quote, you didn't get to see what we saw in terms of discovery. You didn't get to see all the inconsistencies, Canick said. We said in our summation that the government cherry-picked their version that they thought would support the continuation of the narrative. Canick continued, why would he expect this verdict given all the inconsistencies that we saw? However, Kelly could face decades in prison.
Hell yeah.
The jury made up of seven men and five women began deliberating Friday afternoon, the Friday that we recorded that episode on the 23rd. In all, Kelly could face decades in prison at sentencing, which is scheduled for May 4th. So we won't actually know what he'll...
For a while.
Yeah.
Is he detained until then? Yes. Until sentencing? Oh, he's in jail right now?
Oh, yeah.
Like this moment?
Yes.
Fuck yeah.
Absolutely. The verdict comes 13 years after Kelly, whose full name is Robert Sylvester Kelly, was acquitted of child pornography charges in the state in an Illinois state trial. An attorney for Kelly said that they are considering filing an appeal and are disappointed in the verdict. But that is the story of R. Kelly. And let me remind you that this was just New York's. He still has litigation in two other states.
He does?
Yeah.
Yay.
Minnesota and Illinois.
Yay.
So
you're about to get extradited.
Right. Which, really, honestly, depending on what the sentencing is, there's a really good chance that those cases will be dropped just because...
It's such a...
If he gets life in prison, there's no reason to go through the trial process just because of the money that it's going to cost the state.
And he's already in prison.
He's already in prison. So I could see us not ever seeing really justice in those two other states, which is horrible for those victims. But I hope that they are rejoicing in this moment.
That he is gone.
Bye.
I don't want any of that parole shit. I want life without parole.
Yeah, same.
Yeah.
And also RIP to... the Ignition song that I like so much.
That, listen, just a moment of silence for Remix to Ignition. Because I will say that is the song that, right next to Mr. Brightside by The Killers,
oh yeah,
will get me hype unreasonably.
Me too. I did have to give it one last listen and really...
Enjoy just it.
Vibe by myself. And then I had to put it away and delete it from all my playlists in solidarity. It was a difficult move.
Yeah.
But I did do it, so.
Bit of, not fond, but a farewell at the very least.
Yes, absolutely. So that is my conclusion to the story about R. Kelly.
Thanks for the update.
You're welcome.
It was like it was just yesterday.
I'm going to try to not do that again. Because it was very stressful.
Yeah.
But Yeah, I don't think we've ever done a story that's been quite so topical.
No.
So.
I have a lot.
I'm here. I'm ready.
I am doing a big bad.
I forgot you were going to do a big bad.
I'm doing a big bad.
Oh my gosh. So Jenny and I still do not tell each other what we're doing.
No, we try not to. We unless try it's not like to. Super pertinent.
Right. But she had been hinting at a big bad here recently, so.
I have it here in front of me. Let me, do you have a fresh drink?
Yeah, let's
open that sucker up.
We're gonna need her.
You're gonna need her.
All right.
This is, a lot of, remind me at the end of this to read you my sources, because I don't want to spoil it.
Okay.
Okay.
That the only person to remind you is me.
Okay,
Taylor.
This solely rests on your shoulders.
Fuck.
That's a lot of responsibility.
That's too much.
And I'm trusting you with it.
It's too much.
No, it's not. No, it's not. You got it.
All right. I'm nervous.
As you should be.
Okay.
This is fucking gross. On May 27th, 1991, Sandra Smith was enjoying an evening alone in her home. Her tranquility was soon disturbed, however, as she heard a commotion down in the street below. Looking through her window, she saw a young man, naked and bleeding, on the sidewalk. Concerned, she called the local police. Upon arrival, authorities saw a young Laotian man standing in the streets, just as Sandra described over the phone, now accompanied by a tall, slender, conventionally attractive white man who was well-spoken and seemed educated.
They always are.
They always are.
Don't trust well-educated
men. Well-spoken, educated white men.
That's half the people that I know.
That's like every person that I know besides you.
Dang it.
I know. That's a crime to live in Indiana. Anyway, conventionally attractive, well-spoken, educated.
Yeah.
The man eventually convinced attending police that the boy was his 19-year-old boyfriend.
No way.
Yeah.
Jet. Are we doing Dahmer?
Yeah, we're doing Dahmer.
Oh, no.
He's bad.
He's real bad.
He's bad. Okay, so my sources are Inside Edition.
Okay.
An interview and article aired February 1993, The Jeffrey Dahmer Files, AETV.com. Biography.com, History of Murder blog by Sarah Reynolds.
All right. I am.
Get ready.
Buckled in.
I'm so sorry.
Ready to go on this roller coaster ride of a terrible garbage human.
So he eventually convinced attending police that the boy was his 19-year-old boyfriend and that they had quarreled after drinking too much, which explained his like confused and distressed demeanor. Yeah. Amid protests from Sandra, the neighbor, the officers escorted both parties back into the building, where Polaroids were produced as proof of the relationship. The officers, in an impoverished, primarily black neighborhood dealing with a homosexual relationship, it was very fair to say that they were less than thorough in their investigation, if you could even call it that, and categorized the event as domestic dispute, and the three officers left the scene.
They just wanted to get out of there.
They just said, well, I don't care. Bye.
No, they were like, gay men?
Right. Mm. Lock him in the apartment, like, quit causing a ruckus, and don't make me come back out here.
Right.
Had the police asked, they would have known that the young man's name was Conorak Synthasmphone. If they went inside the apartment, they would have seen the deceased, although still intact, body of 31-year-old Anthony Hughes lying on the bed. If they looked, they would have seen the drill holes in Conorak's skull. If they did a breathalyzer, they would have known that Conorak wasn't intoxicated, but rather his brain had been injected with muriatic acid.
What the fuck?
Causing his confused and disoriented state. If they ran a background check, they would have seen that this unassuming, plain white man was convicted of molesting a young boy in 1988. That young man was Conorak's brother. But they did not.
Didn't do any of that.
They didn't do any of that. Ooh. And police would not return to the apartment until July 22nd, 1991, where disgusting homicidal cravings would be brought to light and a several decade-long killing spree would finally end. Conorak Synthasmphone was 14 years old. and pieces of his remains were found when Jeffrey Dahmer's apartment was processed by forensic teams.
He was 14.
He was 14.
And police were just like,
You're telling me you can't tell the difference between a 14-year-old boy and a 19-year-old boy?
That's disturbing.
You're right.
As, I don't spend that much time around young kids, but I just feel very certain that I would be able to figure out the difference between a 14-year-old and somebody who is, like, 19.
Yes.
That's
a whole different ballpark.
Yeah.
That, there's no mistaking.
And how did they not see the burr holes?
They just saw, because, I mean, imagine, they're small, just like regular, like, drill bit hole. That's what he used, a drill. Drill bits.
Okay, yeah.
And so it was just like,
why did he not bleed? He's bleeding, right?
Just like he was in a scuffle, which he said they were. A lover's quarrel. Killers like Jeffrey Dahmer don't just emerge fully formed from one day to the next. They grow up and into their murderous roles. Dahmer's childhood was not without problems. His mother, Joyce Dahmer, suffered from depression and attempted suicide during his childhood. His father, preoccupied with his doctoral work, was largely absent. And David Dahmer, Jeffrey's brother, came along when Jeffrey was 5 years old. Throughout childhood, Jeffrey resented him as a competitor for their parents' scant attention. Between the time Jeffrey was 6 and 8 years old, his family moved frequently before finally setting in Bath, Ohio, where Jeffrey lived until he graduated from high school.
I have a property in Bath.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Over those early years, Joyce and David fought with regularity. Their relationship ended in a messy divorce rife with allegations of extreme cruelty and gross neglect of duty.
Oof.
According to Lewis Schlesinger, a professor of psychology at John Jay College, the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and an expert on serial sexual murder, none of that information correlates to Dahmer's killing spree. Quote, "Lots of people have conflicts with their brothers and sisters. Having your mother attempt suicide and become hospitalized is not a pleasant event, but it does not make you a serial killer." Wallstrom, another researcher, said that as an early adolescent, Dahmer had an off-the-charts libido and constant fantasies about doing harm, more specifically, killing men and having sex with their corpses.
Yikes.
It took up about two-thirds of his day, said Wallstrom, and said that Dahmer told him these facts, and at age 13, Dahmer tried to actualize what was in an imagination. He'd become overcome with lust for a male jogger in his neighborhood. And so one day he hid with a baseball bat near the jogger's route, hoping to make his first kill. But Dahmer told Wallstrom that the man didn't go jogging that day, so he moved on.
Wow.
Yeah. 13. He tried to commit his first murder.
That's crazy.
I'm not trying to say that, like, cardio will get you killed.
But if you don't do it, you have a higher chance of not getting killed.
Well, listen, this fact certainly kept me from doing cardio this morning.
Sure it did.
It did, as with every other morning.
You're like, what if somebody is obsessed with me?
Right.
And they're just waiting.
Yeah. It's laughable.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is. Listen, they wouldn't have to wait for me to, I don't leave the house. I come over here once a week, and that's my excursion.
You go get Theo from school.
I do pick up Theo from school. And sometimes I accidentally run into my Instacart drop-off person.
Oh, okay.
So that's the extent.
Sure.
And for this, you know.
Yeah.
To not get murdered. In an interview with Inside Edition, Jeffrey said that he started having these obsessive thoughts when he was 15 or 16. They were sexual fantasies about control, power, and complete dominance. It was excitement, fear, and pleasure all mixed together.
Couple of things in the brain, not all going where they should be.
No.
Too many crisscrosses.
Correct, yes. In 1978, his fantasies that he was barely keeping at bay finally got the best of him. He knew it was wrong, and the first killing wasn't planned. And he described the murder in an interview, quote, "I was coming back from the shopping mall back in 78. I had fantasies about picking up a hitchhiker and taking him back to the house and having complete dominance and control over him." that hitchhiker turned out to be 18-year-old Stephen Hicks, Dahmer's first victim. He took Hicks to his parents' house in Ohio, where he strangled and beat him with a barbell before dismembering the body and placing it in trash bags. Quote, no one had a clue as to what was happening for over a decade.
Wow.
Dahmer would not murder again until 1987.
So how long was that? 5 years?
This was in 78. So 9 years.
9 years. That's such like a cooling off period, as well, the good old Forensic Criminal Minds would say.
In these quiet years, he joined the army and was stationed for a time in Germany, eventually being discharged due to problems with excessive drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And of those 9 years without a victim, Dahmer said the urge was always there. What he lacked were the right circumstances, saying, there just wasn't an opportunity to fully express what I wanted to do. I want to say that although there's no evidence or confession of any murders while he was stationed in Germany, I doubt that at such a young age he was actually able to control his impulses.
So they think that there's victims.
Yeah, but they don't have any
proof of that.
Yeah, but also he was in the middle. Literally, we don't know. He never confessed.
And he's the kind of guy that has confessed a lot of murders, right?
He, as soon as they presented him with, like, the evidence that I'll discuss later on, he really worked with police and, like, he knew that it was over and he was going to prison, so he was pretty honest.
Right. That's... I don't like it when serial killers kill. Like,
sure.
Like, they say in, like, the BuzzFeed, like, but I like when they have a little thing.
Yeah.
I like it when they, just are like, yeah, I got caught. Here's all my victims.
Yes.
Here's where they all are.
Yes.
Like, the very least that you could do is give some of these families some closure.
Yes.
And I appreciate, I don't know if that's the right word, but that's how I feel.
Send him a thank you card.
Yeah. Just, well, I know that they learned so much from these types of killers, and it has helped us with
preventing more
of them.
Yes.
And so, you know, he could have just killed himself immediately as soon as he thought that he was getting caught and taken all of those secrets with him.
That's true.
He did not do that.
He did not do that. He did not have the choice to do that.
Oh, okay. Tell me, how about you tell me?
Okay, I will. Oh, don't you worry.
I'll stop interrupting.
We can surmise over this all we want. I have all the facts here ready to go.
Weird.
I'm prepared for this.
See, this is exactly how the podcast started, though.
Yes.
Taylor and Jenny sitting over pancakes and being like, aren't you so glad that killers do these things? She says.
Yes.
This is how we got here.
Whew. Yes. I believe 100% that there are Dahmer victims in Germany. I just do. I don't think after suppressing his feelings for so long that he would have been able to control himself.
After having completed one.
Yes.
And knowing that, like, feeling that he got from that.
Yes. And it was, like, as soon as he came back, he was back to it.
Yeah.
Too.
I just... Hard to believe.
Yes, I agree. In September, Dahmer returned to Ohio and he was arrested for a DUI. Huh. And he went to go live with his grandma, the piece of shit. In August, Dahmer was arrested for flashing his genitals at the Wisconsin State Fair and was fined $50.
That's not enough. That's...
At the state fair? You're pulling your digging balls out of the state fair.
Come on. That's at least $500.
It should be, at least. And it's like so, have you been to it? They're so gross, a state fair.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it fit right in.
Honestly. Gross. Sounds right.
Yeah, sounds right. Put some cotton candy on it and call it a day.
I want to die. Oh my god, I can't. Ew, so sticky and disgusting.
What?
Okay, so in August of 1982, Dahmer was arrested for, oh, I told you that, flashing his genitals at the state fair. In August, he was arrested again, August of 1986, this time for oozing his noodle if you will. Oh, the five finger shuffle, poaching his egg, badgering the witness.
Why are we doing this?
Celebrating Palm Sunday. Liquidating the inventory.
I hate you. I hate everything about that.
For doing, he did it in front of two boys.
Okay.
Where? Just out and about.
Just, okay.
He probably just popped out of some bushes.
Ew.
Yeah. He told officers that he was simply urinating.
Uh-huh.
That's all. A simple mistake. Nobody can tell the difference, you know, so similar. Perhaps too enthusiastically, he was urinating.
He was excited about urinating.
He just had to pee so bad.
Ugh, gross.
And then on a bright fall day in 1987, 9 years after his first kill, Jeffrey decided that he was not able to deny his pleasure any longer. On September 15th, 24-year-old Stephen Tamoy went missing after leaving his job at a restaurant in Milwaukee. Stephen was a pretty normal guy. He had grown up in Ontonagon, Michigan, where he graduated from Ontonagon Area High School in 1981. Stephen's family tried searching for him on their own, but when that proved futile, they filed an official missing persons report with the police in December, 3 months since he was last seen. Dahmer originally said he couldn't remember the details of his death, but he later recalled that he had murdered him in a rented room at Ambassador Hotel in Milwaukee. While he couldn't remember the details of that particular murder, he claimed he met Stephen that evening and stated that he must have battered him to death in the hotel room while in a drunken stupor.
Just must have done it that
Just must
way.
Have done it.
I wonder if that hotel's still standing. My guess is no.
Google it. At the Ambassador Hotel in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Dahmer confessed that he brought the body back to his grandmother's house, where he dismembered Stephen in the basement and then threw him in the trash. And I would like to point out that he brought him out of the hotel in pieces in suitcases.
Not cool.
Not cool indeed. In October of 1987, Dahmer bought 14-year-old James, brought 14-year-old James Doxtator to the basement of his grandmother's house after promising him $50 in exchange for posing for nude photos. After drugging him, Dahmer strangled the body and disposed of it in a similar fashion to that of Stephen Tamoy.
Green bean.
What doing?
Don't step on my stuff.
She said, I smell soup. Soup cat. I want to eat the soup cat.
This is about as close as she'll get to me. Don't step on my stuff.
In March. Oh, gosh.
Oh, yeah. We're going to get real up in here.
All right. Dahmer had killed his fifth victim. And this was the first time he kept a trophy. He stored and preserved Anthony Sears' head and genitals, which he kept in a wooden box. In May of 1990, Dahmer killed Raymond Smith, a 32-year-old sex worker. In June of 1990, he killed 27-year-old Edward Smith. In September of 1990, he killed 22-year-old Ernest Miller. This time, he tried something new. He slashed his throat because he ran out of sleeping pills to drug his victim with. He also kept pieces of Ernest to eat later. Yeah.
Pause. This hotel is still standing. And it has gone through a major renovation and is now a luxury hotel.
I love that.
Let me know if you want to stay there. I can book it for you.
I'm solid. Yeah, I would love to go. Let's do it. Next weekend?
Yeah.
Okay great. So in September 1990, he tried a new little thing.
Oh, no.
Where he slashed the throat of Ernest Miller because he ran out of sleeping pills. Also kept pieces to eat. So when interviewed, Dahmer said he was just starting to branch out and explore his desires. Eating the heart and heart muscle, it was a way of making me feel that they were a part of me. First, it was just curiosity, but then it became compulsive. Something that I must do. 3 weeks later, Dahmer killed 22-year-old David Thomas. Later, he said that he came to realize during their encounter that he was not attracted to Thomas, but he still drugged and killed him, then disposed of his body and intentionally did not have sex with him or keep any parts.
Wait, why?
Because he wasn't attracted to him.
Okay.
February 1991, a 10th victim is murdered. Dahmer picked up 17-year-old Curtis Strotter at a bus stop and offered him money in exchange for posing for nude photos. April 1991, Dahmer drugged 19-year-old Errol Lindsay. Lindsay regained consciousness before Dahmer drugged him further and then strangled him and flayed the corpse with hopes to keep his skin.
Oh, little Ed Gein.
Yeah. May 1991 didn't go according to plan. That is when Kenorak nearly escaped. After photographing and drugging him, Dahmer left the drug body alongside Hughes' corpse while he left the apartment for a few hours.
Leaving him there?
He just left him. Returning in the early hours of the following morning, Dahmer discovered groggy Kenorak sitting outside of his apartment building surrounded by cops. So, we know how that story goes.
I cannot believe that.
Yeah.
And they just delivered him back.
So, Anthony's body was laying on the bed before he had disposed of it when he brought Kenorak there. So, like, he kept Kenorak in the living room. The body was on the bed back in the bedroom. He took his photos, which is the evidence that he provided with police to show that they were together, the photos that he had just taken earlier that evening.
So ridiculous.
Yeah.
I just can't believe that the police just were like, here's your victim back.
Right. Here you go. Here you go. Well,
finish
we'll,
him off.
I'll get into that. June 1991, the next month, Dahmer lured 20-year-old Matthew Turner, who he had met in Chicago at the L&L Tavern.
Shut up. No way.
Yeah. Swear.
I didn't know that was a Dahmer place, too. I thought that was a Dahmer just place. Ace.
Nope. He has history in Chicago. He's there. He had two victims that he met from Chicago. Persuaded him to travel, Matthew Turner. Dahmer persuaded Matthew Turner to travel from Chicago to Milwaukee for a photo shoot. Once again, Dahmer drugged, strangled, and dismembered his victim, keeping his head and internal organs in plastic bags in his freezer.
Oof.
July 7th through the 19th, 1991. 7th through the 19th. What's that? 12 days? Three more victims are killed.
That was a lot more fast math than I could do.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. I'm medicated now, so I'm sorry.
Are you?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's why all your stories are done.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Thanks. Okay. So three more victims are killed between July 7th and the 19th. Jeremiah Weinberger, 20, who was also from Chicago, lured under the same circumstances.
Okay.
24-year-old Oliver Lacey. 4 days after murdering Lacey, Jeffrey was fired from his job at the chocolate factory. The same day, he lured Joseph Bredehoft, 25, to his apartment, and he strangled him and left his body laying on the bed for 2 days.
Ugh, what a horrible 2 days.
Then finally, on July 22nd, 1991, two Milwaukee police officers were flagged down by an agitated man with handcuffs attached at one wrist. Tracy Edwards, 32, told the officers a freak had placed the handcuffs on him and that he'd spent the better part of the evening trying to escape from a nearby apartment where he was being held captive. Upon their arrival at his apartment, Dahmer invited the attending officers inside, admitting that he was the one who had placed the handcuffs on Edwards and that the keys were in his nightstand. On entering the bedroom, one officer noticed a partially open drawer filled with Polaroid pictures of numerous bodies in different states of dismemberment. Brandishing the images, the officer returned to the living room, reportedly saying to his partner, "These are for real." Reinforcements are called in to examine the scene.
I could never.
It's horrific. It's horrific. Yeah, just we're coming up on a disclaimer here, so.
All right.
Aside from the noxious smell, like the man, his apartment was unassuming. The living room and kitchen at first glance looked exactly the way you'd expect a single man to live. Pat Kennedy was the detective assigned to the case. Pat Kennedy is a sunshiny, seemingly goofy guy with one hell of a mustache.
Oh, poor Pat. Poor Pat. He's about to have a really bad day.
He is, and he's in the Jeffrey Dahmer file. So if you've seen that documentary, you know who Pat is. He's a character.
Is he? I haven't seen it.
You watch it. Watch it.
Okay.
I bought it for $3.99 on YouTube.
Write it off.
Taxes.
We have an LLC now. We can do shit like that.
He later performed. He was the only person who talked to Dahmer through the entire interrogation process.
Really?
Yes. Yes. He also took the confession from him. And as he started walking up to the apartment building, he noticed that an officer that was already on the scene was walking out of the building in total disarray.
I'm sorry, was Pat a, like, FBI, or was he just Milwaukee police?
He was a Milwaukee homicide detective. Okay. And he was pretty, like, young on the job. Like, it was pretty new.
Okay.
For him. This was, like, the biggest case that he had ever worked.
Probably the biggest case that he would ever work.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Cool.
And it had a, this had a negative impact. I'll talk about it, but, like, right. Yes.
Fucked him up.
Yeah. Yes. For the rest of his life. Fucked him up. He noticed that the officer's hair was disheveled, his utility tool belt, like the gun and handcuff holder that he has, like that officers wear on their waist, is hanging off of him and like
what?
Missing. Yes. It was off kilter. He was sweating profusely. His eyes were as big as saucers. And Pat noted that it was very unlike this officer to be so deeply shaken because he was pretty seasoned. So Pat asked him what the hell was going on, and all the cop could manage to say before throwing up on the sidewalk was go look in the refrigerator.
Uh-uh. No, 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 no. No.
And Pat did.
Oh.
Inside the main compartment of the fridge, it was mostly empty. Aside from a cardboard box.
Except...
Inside of the box was a freshly severed head with the eyes and the mouth wide open in an expression of total shock. There was a box of Arm & Hammer baking soda in the back of the fridge to keep things fresh. The door of the fridge had your typical condiments, ketchup, mustard, A1 sauce, and mayonnaise.
That's disgusting.
I am about to graphically describe what investigators and forensic scientists discovered in his apartment.
That wasn't graphic.
This is the disclaimer of all disclaimers. If you feel icky about anything that I have just said,
please leave.
Do your skip the next minute or two. Love you so much.
See you in a sec.
This is not for you. In plastic bags in the freezer, hearts and hands were found. A small fridge in the living room contained even more body parts.
Like a mini fridge?
Yes.
It's like a mini fridge?
He had a mini fridge that had a head in it.
Oh, God. Okay.
More than an additional 80 Polaroids were discovered.
80?
The photos were taken prior to the victim's murder while they were drugged. Their naked bodies contorted into unimaginable positions while they were murdered. Lots taken during the dismemberment process. Some are available online. I am not sure why. Don't go looking for them. I was not in an emotional place to see a naked young man half hanging out of the bathtub with his chest and ribs splayed open, exposed, with big empty places where his organs should be.
I will not be looking. Normally, I'm the girl that's like, I'm gonna look. They tell me not to, I'm gonna do it. Mm-mm.
I also wasn't ready to see the next photo of this young man's head sitting next to his hands, all in a neat little row on Jeffrey Dahmer's nightstand. Heed my warning.
Please don't do
this
that.
This is not Dylan Redwine in the poop diaper. Do not. When asked about why he took the photos, he said that photographing them was my way of remembering their appearance and their physical beauty. I also wanted to keep something. If I couldn't keep them there with me whole, at least I felt I could keep their skeletons. And I went so far as to setting up an altar with 10 different skulls and partial skeletons. It was supposed to be a sort of memorial, a place where I could collect my thoughts and feed my obsession. During the investigation, they found he wasn't able to like complete it. He got caught before he could finish it. But they found sketches of this. And there is a photo of the sketch on the Instagram, if you would
okay.
like to go see it. In the bedroom, they found a bloodstained wall and mattress, bottles and jugs of bleach and unknown chemicals. Initially, the teams thought that his apartment was rigged for a bomb because of all of the jugs of chemicals that he had in there. That was until they turned their attention to the giant blue barrel in his bedroom. Forensic scientists on the scene described it like this, quote, "There was a large blue container in the corner, and when we moved it, it kind of sloshed around a bit, so we knew that it was filled with fluid, but we didn't know what. We didn't want to open it at the scene and had some concerns about transporting it ourselves. The next morning, the barrel was open, and inside were three partial decomposing skeletons."
Oh,
no. Now listen. I know this has been an uncomfortable time listening to a very graphic description of this literal house of horrors. Mm-hmm. And serving a 6-year sentence in property management, all I could think of while I was researching this is, where is the property manager?
What are you doing?
What are you doing? But hear me out.
Listen, anybody who's ever annoyed about the fact that your property manager wants to come in and do apartment inspections,
this is why.
Please sit down. This is why.
This is why.
And we need to make sure that there are not Komodo dragons eating dudes.
Oh.
We need to make sure that people aren't doing stupid shit.
Stupid shit.
In their apartments. So if you don't have anything to hide, please just shut up. We also
don't want to be in your apartment.
And we don't care about 90% of the shit that you've got going
on. I don't care. You could have 14 bongs sitting on the coffee table.
I see nothing.
I don't care. I literally don't care.
I care about dead bodies.
Are you making meth? Do you know how expensive it is to renovate a 1,000 square foot 2-bedroom apartment for meth?
Right.
$14,000. It's so expensive.
Yeah. And is your animals peeing and pooping everywhere inside?
Yes.
I care about that.
I also care about that.
That's expensive.
I also care if you have bodies in barrels.
Also really not good.
No, not good. And like all the neighbor, I'll get to it. There's so much to unpack still, okay? But after his arrest, old Jeff relayed an instance where his landlord was doing regular unit inspection walks.
What?
And was inside of his apartment with Jeffrey Dahmer, and the property manager asked about the barrel. And Jeffrey said that it was how he disposed of old fish tank water, because he had a big fish tank in his living room, and said that he just dumped the water in there. And so the property manager was like, okay, weird. But I can't stop you from having a barrel.
Yeah, it's okay. I don't think that's against my lease.
No, it's not. It literally makes my skin crawl to think that, like, they were literally doing their job. I've seen weird shit inside of people's apartments. Like, he inquired or she inquired. They inquired like they were supposed to like, get to the bottom of it. I don't know. One time I walked into an apartment that was filled with lizards. And I, like, lit, like, multiple cages of lizards.
Mm-hmm.
And I just... This is not my finest moment in property management, but I walked out.
You were just like, nope.
No, I'm not dealing with 6 lizards today.
Listen, one thing I tell all of my people is you pick your battles.
You have to.
If you fight every single war you come across, you will leave your whole entire body at the door. Office. You're, like, you will waste away.
You're going to make 120-hour weeks. Like, you just cannot fight every single thing.
No.
No. If I walked into an apartment and I saw a barrel, I probably would not even ask.
No, same. I would be like, fucking weird.
Okay.
And I think truly my true crime brain would be like, is Sus. That something? Also, I'm probably overreacting.
Same.
And if it was, like, I can think of like 10 residents off the top of my head that if they looked me in the eye and they were like, yeah, it's fish water, I'd be like,
yeah.
Legit.
Yeah.
You're freaking weird, but
yes.
Like, you're an educated person.
Right. So who has a clean apartment and is
pays rent on time. Like, I don't have any problems with you.
No.
It's probably fish water.
Yeah.
Like, weird, but okay.
Okay. I don't care what you do with your fish water. You keep it in a barrel if you want. But that's not what was in there.
Humans are disgusting and horrible.
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
So officers brought out box after box filled with terrible things that they found in the apartment.
That's horrible.
First 10 boxes, then 20, and then 30, and then 40. until there were over 60 boxes lining the halls of the apartment building.
Oh, no.
It was described by the head forensic investigator as trying to dismantle somebody's museum.
That's horrible.
In the closet at the end of the hall, there was a large stainless steel pot. Inside the pot were hands and penises that had been raisined, for lack of a better term. Naturally mummified, perhaps. There were three skulls that he had painted with a gray granite-like paint for his altar. The forensic scientists at first were impressed with the quality of the skulls because they did not think it was actually human. But when the assistant scraped off the paint from the tooth, they were shocked to find enamel underneath. And the team realized they had an additional three skulls.
They just thought that they were, like, fake.
Yes.
Decoration skulls.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why, because there's a head in both fridges.
I would immediately assume
that it's a real head.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Fake skulls would be like number four on my list of possibilities.
Yep.
I think they were probably just delusional and hoping for the best.
In all,
yeah.
Authorities found four other severed heads in his kitchen, two human hearts in the refrigerator, seven skulls in the bedroom.
What?
As well as an entire human torso in his freezer.
No.
Further investigation at the apartment would reveal other preserved sexual organs, two entire skeletons, severed hands, heads, feet, and a further three torsos that were submerged in acid.
How many square feet is this apartment?
It is very small. I have the floor plan. It is on the Insta. No. I would guess it's probably around 700 square feet.
That is like a body part per square foot.
Yes. Yeah, what's the body part per square foot of this apartment?
God, no. Okay.
Dennis Murphy, who is described as a crusty old prick by Pat.
Pat. Damn, dude.
Dude, he's cold. He was an excellent homicide detective. He was in charge of identifying each and every victim.
Woof.
Woof indeed. Especially considering all they had were parts. There was not one full set, one fully assembled skeleton. It was miscellaneous parts.
You're going to tell me. Never mind.
You can ask.
What did he do with the random parts that we don't have?
I dissolved them in acid, ate them. Otherwise, they were mostly preserved and stuffed away in corners of his apartment.
So it was like puzzle pieces, but like you're
yes.
missing one piece.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. In 1991, the human genome research that was underway wasn't really being used for law enforcement purposes at all. So to figure it out, they had to take info from Jeff and try to corroborate it with the body parts. And don't forget that some victims had no parts left behind.
Okay, so he like dissolved.
He made a list of everybody that he had murdered in that apartment, and some of those people were none of their body parts were not in the apartment.
But he kept a list.
He knew.
Oh, okay.
He's a smart guy. Generally high IQ.
Wow. Okay.
Yep. So, they would determine a date that he picked his victim and committed the murder. He would give general demographics, age, sex, race, height, and they would apply those descriptions to missing persons report for the same period of time. From there, detectives would have to do legwork to reach out to the families to follow up on the missing persons report. Then they would ask for photo IDs from the family, take them to Jeff.
And be like, this one?
Yes. And he would give a positive ID. There was also a little bit of dental identification, a decent amount, actually. It took 6 weeks to identify all of the victims' parts that they found in their apartment, which is remarkable considering the amount of like old-fashioned detectivery at work here. Though through this method, they were also able to identify victims whose remains were not present in the home. Although initially forthcoming with information regarding his crimes, he withheld certain parts of his killing ritual from detectives until forensic teams presented a new discovery. The skulls in his apartment all had tiny drilled holes seemingly into the brain tissue. And they were able to tell via the amount of hemorrhaging that they were created prior to death.
Ooh.
It wasn't until then that Jeff disclosed to Pat that he went through a weird phase, as he said. A weird phase.
A weird phase.
Just like growth, you know? We're all evolving.
Just like the emo stage in seventh grade that we all went through.
The Panic at the Disco phase.
Oh, I'm still in that.
Same. Oh, same.
Best concert I've ever been to.
I swear.
Hands down.
It was so much fun. That was a good concert. So here's his thing. He would drill holes into their brain because he wanted to create living zombies because he wanted to have complete, he wanted to eat bits of them fresh. I'm so sorry. He would inject their brain with muriatic acid or boiling water. Forensic evidence showed that from the point of injury to the time of death, quite a bit of time would elapse.
That's the worst.
He figured if he kept them alive that he would have to go out and kill less. So he was trying to be humane.
Oh!
Oh, so thoughtful.
How kind.
He hoped that it would injure the part of the brain that controlled their ability to talk or have needs and would just leave them alive.
He just wanted vegetables.
Yes, correct. Exactly, yes. That's what he wanted. He said that everyone he tried it with eventually died, and it never led to the level of success that he desired.
Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm. He was a monster. An absolute monster. Jeffrey Dahmer killed a lot of young men. Primarily young, gay, black men. Or children, in most cases. There were missing persons reports and families worried about them, but not police work being done to find them. Justifiably, the precinct went under some extreme public ridicule and scrutiny as to their lack of concern with the missing victims. It was argued that if this was happening to white men in an affluent neighborhood, the precinct would have been more proactive in following leads and discovering a serial killer in their midst.
Yeah.
And I think those people are right.
Probably.
All of the neighbors, like in months leading up to his arrest, had called the landlord, the management company, the Department of Health, like Human Protective Services, because there was this odor, like bodies being decomposed in the apartment next to you. And because it was always, he was never home during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And because he was an affluent, well-educated white man who mind his business and never caused any trouble, they never wanted to like go in or interrupt or bother him. So they never walked his apartment.
So they didn't want to do their jobs.
Got it. Yep. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to put this in my training manual and be like, this is what happened when you don't do your job.
Correct. This is what due diligence
Jeffrey is Dahmer for. Is going to happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't do your freaking job.
It's a good scare tactic.
I'm going to do it.
It took a jury only 5 hours to find Jeff sane and guilty.
Oh, okay.
No.
I feel like, no, sane and guilty. Know the story. Okay.
The insanity plea initially held up because he was labeled as a necrophiliac. However, because he also engaged in consensual sexual activities with living partners, he was instead found sane. He would get a power trip on convincing these men to come back to his apartment and have, like, just, like, regular hookup sex.
I'm sorry. I don't know why he does that.
Do you have you got eczema.
He got something. He's just a little sniffly.
A little sniffly boy.
He does it in the middle of the night. It scares the shit out of me.
He scared the shit out of me right now. Anyway, they were saying that that because part of his power trip was to have just like regular hookup sex with these men and then drug them and kill them.
Okay, so he didn't have regular hookup sex with people and then just like let them scurry on and do their life. Like,
nay, nay.
Okay, so he would hook up with them.
Yes.
Let them get a little farther away and then invite them back.
So, no, he would go to bars. That's where he met these men. Okay. Gay bars, work in the streets.
L&L.
L&L. And he would say, like, hey, come back to my apartment. I'll give you $50 if you let me take nude photos of you. Or just, come back to my apartment. Let's hook up. And they would. Mm-hmm. And he would hook up with them. And then while they were there hanging out, he would drug them.
Okay. All right. So it might have started out as the hookup, but he always had the intention of murdering them.
Yes. Okay. But because he would have living consensual sex with them before he murdered them, the insanity plea would not hold up and label him as a sole necrophiliac.
Got it. Okay. Okay. Cool.
So in 1992... Jeffrey Dahmer was found legally sane and sentenced to 957 years after he confessed to 17 murders.
God damn.
2 years later, at the age of 34, he was killed by another inmate at the Columbia Correctional Institution in Portage, Wisconsin.
No!
He got beat to death.
Oh, damn.
I know. When asked why he did what he did, he had this to say. I felt so hopelessly evil and perverted that I actually derived a sort of pleasure from this. I had too many obsessive desires and thoughts wanting to control them, possess them permanently, and that's why I killed them. Not because I was angry at them or wanted to hurt them, because I wanted to dominate them.
Ugh.
And that is the story of Jeffrey Dahmer.
Horrible. So glad you tackled it. You did an excellent job. How horrible.
Big fucking gross.
Big gross.
So this is, I didn't even have like time because I thought this was like 1,000 pages long to get into like the media firestorm.
Oh my God. I bet it was massive.
So there were people protesting the police department, protesting Dahmer, all of the chaos in an apartment building. He is not the only person there. They didn't relocate any of the people who lived in that building. They didn't provide any kind of social services to them. So people are gathered. So the girl who called the police at the very beginning had a red leather couch that Jeffrey had given to her. And people were offering to pay her $50 to come sit on the couch. Another man in the same building had, like, Jeffrey asked for a cup of water, and so he gave him water out of his cup, and people were paying $5 to drink out of the same cup as, like, Jeffrey Dahmer.
People are fucking weird.
Yeah, they're so... But the same could be true about the Gabby... Like, the Gabby Petito case has become such, like, a huge fire. I don't know where that is, like, in real time, where this is airing, but, like, Brian's still missing.
He's not missing. He's hiding.
I think he killed himself.
I think he killed himself, too.
Yeah.
That's not missing.
Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, so there was, like, a huge social media. And, like, these people were trying. So the first couple nights, everybody left their apartment, and they went down and they slept in the lobby together of the apartment building they couldn't stand to, like, be
alone.
Yeah.
That's, like, heartbreaking, but also really wholesome.
Yeah.
I cannot imagine being that property manager. I would literally quit my job.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I quit my job for a lot fucking less.
Listen, I had one singular mingular resident that nearly ended me, and that person was not a murderer.
No. Just mean.
Just mean. And I cannot imagine having to wake up in your perfectly normal suburban home and go to work.
Oh.
And not
to where your residents are living in a crime scene.
Your residents are living in a crime scene. You have the police demanding things from you.
Yep.
You have your residents demanding answers.
Yes.
I'm not sure where Fair Housing was in 1991, but... there had to be something.
I can tell you it was before the Americans with Disability Act.
That's true. Oh my gosh, there would be so much. I would probably just hand over my keys and be like, have at it. I don't know.
Yeah.
Have at it. This is above my pay grade.
I could not imagine. Fucking awful.
Yikes.
Yikes.
Good job.
Fucking indeed. Thank you. Anyway, that's a terrible story of Jeffrey Dahmer. What's your bright and shiny? Switch gears.
What is my bright and shiny? You brought me soup.
I did. I bring you soup and a Yeti.
Yeah, you brought me soup. I think that's our love language.
Soup?
Soup. When bad things happen in our lives, the first thought is,
chicken noodle
I have
soup. Soup. I'll make soup.
Jenny's mom died and I said, I made soup today.
Yes.
Yes. And I brought soup at midnight.
We got bad news today. I'm like, listen, Taylor, don't you
I
worry
got
about
soup.
It. I made soup.
Don't you worry. It's fine.
Is it our trauma meal?
Probably.
Okay. It's okay. Listen, I'm not mad about any excuse to make soup.
Yeah. So Jenny brought me soup today. That's my bright and shiny.
It's your bright and shiny.
Yeah. What about you?
My bright and shiny today is, oh my gosh, I feel like I just have so many options. I'm really thankful for advances in therapy and psychology.
Yeah.
Because I know I said it before, but like I was recently diagnosed with crazy ADD, which is so annoying, but I'm medicated now.
Yeah.
And I can't believe that this is how y'all feel all the time.
I am so excited.
Is this
for
you. Just how you just do stuff? Is that what you do?
You just do
stuff and you don't struggle. It has changed my entire
path.
Truly, though.
Like, Jenny has recently started putting like her pictures in the Gmail account so I can post them to the Instagram.
Yes.
And so I get like the notification when she puts something new in there, and she's like three stories ahead of me, and I was like feeling like, oh no, what have I done to myself?
Well, because we're so
now it makes a lot of sense.
Yes, it's because of the Adderall. It's not actually me
it
performing.
Is you.
No, it's not.
This is how it's supposed to be, though. Like, this is your brain working the way it's supposed to.
Which is insane. I went into my last therapy appointment this week because the left side of my brain retains zero attention. And I walked into the appointment and I was like, Kev, listen, what's the likelihood that this test was wrong? And he was like, 0%. And I was like, okay. I was like, but wait, I really feel like I could do a lot better.
Let me try again.
Yeah. And he was like, do you want to? It's going to be the same. He's like, you can't control it. It's your brain. It's not like you failed a test in history.
You didn't study hard enough.
Right. So yes, that is my bright and shiny.
I'm happy for you.
Thank you. It's a whole new fucking world out here.
I bet. It's like you're not colorblind anymore.
Yes, is honestly what it feels like. Have you ever just sat there and your brain is quiet? And you don't have like...
When I'm disassociating.
Oh, well.
Yes.
Call Kevin.
He doesn't want to hear from me again today.
Again?
Chats.
You did?
A little.
You sneak in therapy from my therapist?
You sneak in therapy from my stepdad?
To be fair, he was my therapist before he was your stepdad.
It's true. It's true.
Oh my god, I love it. Okay, well, follow us on the social media.
Yeah, come see us at DeadCon.
Come see us at DeadCon.
Leave us a review if you like us.
Yes, love you so much. Hope you liked our live.
Yeah, let us know.
Let us know. We'll do it again if you guys liked it.
Yeah,
let us know.
We, I'm sure, had fun.
Send us more grab bag stories.
Yeah,
for us to be able to do it again.
Keep doing it.
And we love you.
Yeah, so be kind to yourself
and to others.
Goodbye.